Daniel chapter 11, verse 1. During the last bonus episode, we already studied how Daniel chapter 9, verse 24 represents the 70-week ministry of Jesus Christ. But it was a double-layered prophecy, and it also represented the 490-year time period from the time that Jerusalem was rebuilt to when Christ was born. And the angel now is going to tell Daniel all of the events during that time period, up until the time that Rome becomes the fourth great empire of the world. Daniel chapter 11 is also going to give us a little glimmer of the Antichrist to come. At the beginning of chapter 11, it starts out talking a lot about the king of the north and the king of the south, but it doesn't mention any names. The king of the north is the Syrian kingdom, and the king of the south is the Egyptian kingdom. Both of these empires started battling each other after Alexander the Great died, and he divided the kingdom of the Greeks up into four parts, and the two strongest parts were the northern kingdom of the Syrians and the southern kingdom of Egypt. So the northern and the southern kingdom started fighting each other back and forth to gain power, and caught between the middle was little tiny Israel, which is geographically in the middle of these two kingdoms, and it's the only country that was in between these two kingdoms. So they were using Israel as a punching bag whenever they got upset with each other, and they were also using Israel as a doormat to walk across to go battle each other. This was a very uncomfortable time for Israel. The reason no names are mentioned is because God is orchestrating the bigger picture. So this prophecy isn't about any one person. It's about the bigger picture of how all of this world history affects Israel. So that's another clue that shows us that Daniel did receive this prophecy and write it down about 300 years before it occurred. Because if the book of Daniel were a fraud and somebody wrote it down after the fact, they would not see the bigger picture, and they wouldn't see that these prophecies should all be about Israel, and it's more about kingdoms and kingships than it is about any particular king or queen. And they would end up throwing names in there because they would know who the names were, and they'd also go off on rabbit trails about individual aspects of each kingship. But you don't see that here in the prophecy that the angel gave to Daniel. It stays on course, focusing on the historical events that affected Israel, and it doesn't focus too much on any one person. For instance, it does talk about Cleopatra, but it doesn't go into vast detail about her sordid life. It only mentions her in reference to how her life affected the Israelites. Here the angel's prophecy begins. Verse 1. And I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, my standing is for a strengthener and for a stronghold to him. In this chapter and in the last chapter, the angel never named himself, but we can assume this is the angel Gabriel speaking, because he's the one who spoke to Daniel in chapter 8. And since Daniel hasn't said anything different, then we can assume it's still Gabriel who is talking to him. Gabriel says that he, the angel Gabriel, was standing to strengthen Darius when Darius the Mede came into power in Persia. Now, Darius the Mede probably had no idea that Gabriel even existed, because angels act on God's command and they do stuff without us ever knowing. Angels carry out God's wishes. 2. And now, truth I declare to thee, lo, yet three kings are standing for Persia, and the fourth doth come far richer than all, and according to his strength by his riches he stirreth up the whole, with the kingdom of Javan. Gabriel says that three more kings will come into power after Darius in Persia, and then the fourth king who comes into power after that will come against the kingdom of Greece. Javan means Greece. King Cyrus was the next king, so he's the first one that the angel is talking about. And then after that, it was Cyrus's son, Cambyses II. And then after that, it was King Artaxerxes, who was Esther's husband. And we read about him in the book of Esther. And then after Artaxerxes, the fourth king is Xerxes. And Xerxes was much richer than the other three kings had been. And he fought against Greece. Greece becomes the next great empire. So evidently Xerxes didn't do very well against Greece. 3. And a mighty king hath stood, and he hath ruled a great dominion, and hath done according to his will. That is Alexander the Great, who fights for the Greeks. And Alexander the Great becomes the leader of the Greek Empire that overtakes the Persian Empire. So the land that the Persians had now is overtaken by the Greeks. 4. And according to his standing is his kingdom broken and divided to the four winds of the heavens, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion that he ruled, for his kingdom is plucked up, and for others apart from these. When Alexander died, the kingdom was divided between his four top generals instead of it being given to his son. So his own personal legacy did not continue. Alexander the Great died in 323 BC. As these prophecies go forward, we'll get closer and closer to the time of Christ. So the four generals are Seleucus Nicanor, and he controls Syria, which is in the north. And then there's Ptolemaeus Lagus, who controls Egypt, and then Cassander, who controls Macedonia and what we would call Greece, and then Lysimachus, who controls Thrace, Asia Minor. The big two territories are Ptolemy's territory in the south, which is Egypt, and Seleucus's territory, which is in the north, which is the region of Syria. If you try to do research on this, you might come up with different names, and that's because these people in history sometimes went by different names. 5. And a king of the south, even his princes, doth become strong, and doth prevail against him, and he hath ruled. A great dominion is his dominion. The pronouns never explain who they're talking about. The only way we know who it's talking about is by looking back at history and then assigning that pronoun to the proper person. And like I said, this is talking about two kingdoms battling, and the focal point is the two kingdoms. So it refers to these two kingdoms as people with their own pronoun. Sometimes the he will be one particular king in that kingdom, and the other times the same pronoun will be used for a successive leader in the same kingdom. So at this point, it's talking about Ptolemy I, who ruled in Egypt. He also controlled Phoenicia, Arabia, Libya, Ethiopia, and some other places. That was his southern kingdom. And Seleucus I Nicator is the one who's in control of the northern kingdom, Syria. 6. And at the end of years they do join themselves together, and a daughter of the king of the south doth come in unto the king of the north to do upright things, and she doth not retain the power of the arm, and he doth not stand, nor his arm, and she is given up, she and those bringing her in, and her child, and he who is strengthening her in these times. Both the Christian and the secular historians agree on what this history is talking about, because it's so clear. This is talking about when Ptolemy gave his daughter Bernice in marriage to the northern rival king Antiochus II Theos, and that was the king of Syria. The reason Ptolemy from Egypt gave his daughter to the Syrian king was to try to control Syria, because a marriage alliance is a political alliance as well. So he was basically trying to manipulate Syria. Antiochus II took Bernice as a wife, but he was already married to a lady named Laodice. So he had to kind of set Laodice aside and take Bernice in order to maintain a friendship with Ptolemy from Egypt. So of course this made Laodice really angry. But as soon as Ptolemy I from Egypt died in 283 BC, then Antiochus Theos divorced Bernice because he didn't have to pretend that he was friends with Ptolemy anymore since Ptolemy was dead, and he took Laodice back as his wife. But Laodice didn't trust anybody at this point, and she wanted revenge. She had all of her enemies killed. She poisoned Bernice, the other woman, and she also poisoned her husband, Antiochus Theos. She set up her son, who was also the son of Antiochus, as the next king. Her son's name was Seleucus Callinicus. We saw the word arm in this verse because your arm is your son, just as the right arm of God in the Old Testament always refers to his son. 7. And one hath stood up from a branch of her roots in his station, and he cometh in unto the bulwark, yea, he cometh into a stronghold of the king of the south, and hath wrought against him, and hath done mightily. Bernice was killed by Laodice for revenge, but Bernice's brother was real angry about that. His name was Ptolemaeus III. He was from Egypt, and he came up to fight Syria because his sister had been killed when she was given to be a wife. So he fought against the king of Syria, which was Seleucus Callinicus, and he plundered the temples in Syria. 8. And also their gods with their princes, with their desirable vessels of silver and gold, into captivity he bringeth into Egypt, and he doth stand more years than the king of the north. Bernice's brother Ptolemaeus III successfully robs the temples of Syria and takes that plunder back to Egypt, and he lived longer than the king of Syria, Seleucus Callinicus. And it's noted in history that he took 40,000 talents of silver and 2,500 sacred objects out of Syria and took them to Egypt. 9. And the king of the south hath come into the kingdom and turned back unto his own land. Now remember, when they're going back and forth, they're always going through Israel, trampling all over Israel and terrorizing those people. Ptolemaeus III stopped fighting the north for a while. 10. And his sons stir themselves up and have gathered a multitude of great forces, and he hath certainly come in and overflowed and passed through, and he turneth back, and they stir themselves up unto his stronghold. Antiochus III, who is also called Antiochus the Great, and his brother rises into power, and they invade the Seleucid kingdom in the north. They take Gaza, or at least they attack in Gaza. But Antiochus really stays in power, and his brother kind of diminishes after that. Antiochus's father was Seleucus II. 11. And the king of the south doth become embittered, and hath gone forth and fought with him, with the king of the north, and hath caused a great multitude to stand, and the multitude hath been given into his hand. Ptolemy the IV Philopater from the south is in a rage against Antiochus the Great, which is Antiochus III, and he defeats Antiochus in the Battle of Raphia using elephants to fight with. This happens in 217 BC. This is the southern kingdom winning a battle against the northern kingdom. 12. And he hath carried away the multitude, his heart is high, and he hath caused myriads to fall, and he doth not become strong. Ptolemy the IV killed 10,000 men in that battle, but he became proud and thus lazy and pleasure-seeking after that battle. And because of this, he could not fully conquer Syria. He just rested on his laurels of that first battle and didn't keep fighting, so he never totally took over Syria. He hated the Jews, and the Egyptians, his own people, didn't like him much either because he was so lazy and he wouldn't continue fighting the Syrians. 13. And the king of the north hath turned back, and hath caused a multitude to stand, greater than the first. And at the end of the times, a second time, he doth certainly come in with a great force and with much substance. We're continuing to move forward in time. In 196 BC, Ptolemy the Fifth, Epiphanes, became king at the age of 5, after his father died. And this encouraged Antiochus the Great to try to attack Egypt, because now Egypt had a 5-year-old king. So Antiochus knew that he could really take advantage of that situation. 14. And in those times many do stand up against the king of the south, and sons of the destroyers of thy people do lift themselves up to establish the vision, and they have stumbled. Even the Israelites helped fight against Egypt at this time. The Seleucids were able to convince the Israelites that, hey, we can fight against a 5-year-old king. Some of the Israelites who were not following the Lord joined the Seleucid army, which is the army of Syria, and they fought against Egypt. The Romans also were meddling in this situation. They thought that they could also gain some control of Egypt since it was a child king. They sent over so-called counselors to help the king. Then that way they could just, through manipulation, control his decision-making. So everybody was pouncing on Ptolemy the Fifth Epiphanes. The reason the Romans meddled is because they knew that if the kingdom of Greece was ever united again, it would be so powerful that Rome wouldn't be able to fight it. And Rome liked the kingdom of Greece being divided into 4 parts. They didn't want the south to win the north, or the north to win over the south, because then Greece would have one king and it would be indefeatable. The Romans wanted to try to prevent either side from winning against the other. And Rome is famous for the saying, divide and conquer. They love it when their opponents are divided, because that way they can dominate both sides. So Rome was effectively co-ruling in Egypt. And Rome is also the destroyers of Israel that are mentioned here, because there's many times when Rome ransacked Israel. 15. And the king of the north cometh in and poureth out a mount, and he hath captured fenced cities, and the arms of the south do not stand, nor the people of his choice. Yea, there is no power to stand. Antiochus the Great went to battle in Panium, and in that battle Egypt was defeated. The prime minister of the child king Ptolemy the Fifth tried to help him, but that prime minister failed. And the control of Jerusalem went to the northern kingdom, the Seleucids, because Egypt had been defeated in that battle. 16. And he who is coming unto him doth according to his will, and there is none standing before him, and he standeth in the desirable land, and it is wholly in his hand. Rome had some battles where they conquered Syria, and thus they also were able to take over Jerusalem as well. 17. And he setteth his face to go in with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him, and he hath wrought, and the daughter of women he giveth to him, to corrupt her, and she doth not stand, nor is for him. Rome is meddling a lot, and ultimately Rome will become the 4th great empire. It's not the 4th great empire yet, but it's working its way by meddling in the affairs of the Seleucid and the Egyptian kingdoms. The Ptolemy king at this time apparently had allegiance to both Rome and Egypt, and he wanted Rome to take over Egypt. So he gave his daughter Cleopatra in marriage to the Egyptian king, who happened to be her brother. And that way he thought that he could use her as an agent to help turn Egypt into an agent of Rome. But she enjoyed being a ruler in Egypt. Her position was actually not what her father wanted. It was to help Egypt remain sovereign, because she liked ruling over Egypt. And it says that he gave her over to corrupt her, And that's because by marrying her brother, she was committing incest and therefore corrupted, because incest is an abomination before the Lord. This incest was all about power. By brother and sister marrying each other, all of the power stayed in the same family. Cleopatra, I think, was older than her brother, so it was easier for her to dominate that relationship and take control. 18. And he turneth back his face to the isles, and hath captured many, and a prince hath caused his reproach of him to cease. Without his reproach he turneth it back to him. In 190 BC, Antiochus III, the Great, is forced to surrender to Rome. He lost the Battle of Magnesia and had to sign a humiliating treaty that would force him to pay lots of money to Rome and give them territory. 19. And he turneth back his face to the strongholds of his land, and hath stumbled and fallen, and is not found. Antiochus III the Great was killed in the Temple of Baal, where he was trying to rob money as tribute in 187 BC. When he went into the Temple of Baal to basically rob it to help pay his debt to Rome, the people in the temple did not like that, and so one of them killed him. 20. And stood up on his station hath one, causing an exactor to pass over the honor of the kingdom, and in a few days he is destroyed, and not in anger nor in battle. The son of Antiochus, which is Seleucid IV, was killed by his own tax collector in 175 BC when he was using the tax collector to take money from Jerusalem. He needed money too, really bad, so he decided to rob the temple in Jerusalem, so he sent a tax collector there to demand money, but that tax collector actually poisoned him, and he died. 21. And stood up on his station hath a despicable one, and they have not given unto him the honor of the kingdom, and he hath come in quietly, and hath strengthened the kingdom by flatteries. Never trust anybody who flatters you. They're always a manipulator. Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, is what this is talking about now, and he was a huge enemy of the people of Israel, and there's going to be several verses now that talk about him. He is a type of the Antichrist, because his life foreshadowed the way the Antichrist is going to treat the Jews in the end times. He used flattery and schmoozing to get his position. He was not born to be king, but through flattery and manipulations, he was able to take that position. And he is the little horn that Daniel chapter 8 was talking about. He is a little horn that came up in the kingdom of Greece. 22. And the arms of the flood are overflowed from before him, and are broken, and also the leader of the covenant. Antiochus Epiphanes' brother was supposed to be the leader of the covenant. He was supposed to inherit the kingdom, but Antiochus arranged to have his brother held hostage in Rome. Then he pretended that he was just keeping his brother's seat warm. And he said, oh, when he returns, then, you know, I'll give the kingship to him. But meanwhile, in the background, Antiochus was manipulating through intrigues to make sure that his brother never returned. 23. And after they join themselves unto him, he worketh deceit, and hath increased, and hath been strong by a few of the nation. Antiochus IV also used flattery and bribes to win friends and to control other people. He pretended that he was helping Egypt, but he was actually using relationships to control Egypt. So he already has the control of Syria, and he wanted to dominate Egypt. 24. Peaceably, even into the fertile places of the province, he cometh, and he hath done that which his fathers did not, nor his fathers' fathers, prey and spoil and substance. To them he scattereth, and against fenced places he deviseth his devices, even for a time. Antiochus IV, who is Antiochus Epiphanes, was known for bribing people with wealth. He always had plans to violate borders. In other words, he wanted Egypt, he wanted Israel, he wanted all of it. 25. And he stirreth up his power and his heart against the king of the south with a great force, and the king of the south stirreth himself up to battle with a very great and mighty force, and standeth not, for they devise devices against him. This is the second battle against Egypt by Antiochus the IV Epiphanes, and he was fighting against Ptolemy the VI, which is Ptolemaeus the VI Philometor. 26. And those eating his portion of food destroy him, and his force overfloweth, and fallen have many wounded. Ptolemy the VI's counselors encouraged him to fight Antiochus Epiphanes, because they knew that he would not win. Even though he had the greater army, he didn't know how to engage in battle. So they knew that if he fought Antiochus, Antiochus would win. They betrayed him by giving him the bad advice that he should go to war. Ptolemy the VI would be defeated. 27. And both of the king's hearts are to do evil, and at one table they speak lies, and it doth not prosper. For yet the end is at a time appointed. Antiochus the IV and Ptolemy the VIII, which would be the next Ptolemy, were sitting at the same table deceiving and flattering and trying to manipulate each other, making each other promises. It's the ultimate narcissistic conversation. They talk about how they're really good friends and they're going to help each other, but in reality, they would stab each other in the back in a heartbeat if they could. 28. And he turneth back to his land with great substance, and his heart is against the holy covenant, and he hath wrought and turned back to his land. Antiochus the IV dealt ruthlessly with Israel. He killed 80,000 people in Israel, and this is the beginning of the Maccabean revolt. Antiochus Epiphanes is still doing all of his bad stuff, and he's still alive. Now the Maccabees are revolting against him because he's trying to force the Israelites to worship false gods. 29. And at the appointed time he turneth back and hath come against the south, and it is not as the former and as the latter. Antiochus the IV Epiphanes invades Egypt again, but he loses this time. It isn't like before when he won over Egypt. 30. And ships of Chittim have come in against him, and he hath been pained, and hath turned back, and hath been insolent toward the holy covenant, and hath wrought and turned back, and he understandeth concerning those forsaking the holy covenant. Antiochus Epiphanes was shamed by the Romans. He wanted to fight Egypt, and he was on his way to go fight Egypt again, but then the Roman ships came, and they met him on the seashore, and one of their generals named Linnaeus drew a circle around him in the sand and said, "You have to decide before you step out of this circle if you're going to fight Egypt or not." And the Roman general said, "If you continue and you go forward and fight Egypt, then we are going to fight you as well. You're going to have to battle Rome and Egypt at the same time. But if you turn back and go home with your tail between your legs, then we won't fight you." So they humiliated him because he had no choice but to turn back. He had to admit that he could not conquer Rome at that time and conquer Egypt too. He was so humiliated and embarrassed that when he went back through the Israel territory to the north, he took it out on the Israelites. He started killing them and desecrating their temple. 31. And strong ones out of him stand up and have polluted the sanctuary, the stronghold, and have turned aside the continual sacrifice and appointed the desolating abomination. Just like the Antichrist in the end times, Antiochus Epiphanes desolated the temple. He set up an abomination in the temple. When he was taking out his wrath on the Jews, he had pigs sacrificed on the Jewish altar that was only for the Lord, and he set up a statue of Zeus to represent himself in the temple as God, and he also made them stop doing the daily sacrifice. The Levites weren't allowed to do the daily sacrifice anymore, and evil Jews who sided with Antiochus because they wanted to practice paganism, those guys, along with Antiochus's soldiers, took the candlestick and the incense altar out of the temple, and that also was a huge defilement. Antiochus also waged war on mothers who would get their sons circumcised, and Antiochus killed their sons and had the dead babies tied around their mothers' necks. And he also savagely tortured people who refused to eat the pig meat. This persecution caused apostasy, just as it will in the end times. You see, when he told the people, either worship pagan gods or die, a lot of them rose up and said, oh yeah, we'll be happy to worship your pagan gods. And the same thing will happen when the Antichrist comes in the end times. He will tell the whole world, either get my mark or you will die. And a lot of Christians are going to stand up and side with the Antichrist, and they're going to go, oh, we'll be really happy to get that mark right away, sir. And they won't have any problem with going into apostasy in order to save their mortal lives. 32. And those acting wickedly against the covenant, he defileth by flatteries, and the people knowing their God are strong and have wrought. Antiochus Epiphanes worked with the evil Jews. They helped him teach other Jews to practice paganism. 33. And the teachers of the people give understanding to many, and they have stumbled by sword and by flame, by captivity and by spoil, days, which means many days. Antiochus burned alive the priests who refused to violate the laws of the Lord. The Maccabean revolt began because the Maccabees wanted to purify the temple and get all of the idolatry out of the temple. So they started fighting for what they believed. They died to purify the temple. So there was revival. Now, just like in the tribulation in the end times, tribulation will cause apostasy and revival, because some people will choose to save their mortal lives and they will commit apostasy and sin. And other people will choose to save their spiritual lives and they will fight for the Lord's cause, and their mortal lives will be lost, but they will go to heaven. When the Antichrist comes, don't fight for your mortal life, fight for your spiritual life. 34. And in their stumbling they are helped, a little help, and joined to them have been many with flatteries. Some people joined the Maccabees because they saw that the Maccabees were gaining power, and they used flattery to infiltrate the Maccabees' revolt for the sake of power, not for zeal to cleanse the temple. There's always profiteers. They want to jump on the bandwagon and be a part of things. But they're thinking of themselves. They're not really fighting for the cause. 35. And some of the teachers do stumble for refining by them, and for purifying, and for making white, till the end of the time, for it is yet for a time appointed. The Maccabees died for their cause, and many people were purified in this process, because they died to obey the Lord and his commandments. Also in the end times, the same thing will happen. People who may have been lukewarm Christians in the end times will rise up and they will become purified because they'll be willing to die to obey his commands. People who are casual about Jesus now, in the end times, they won't be casual anymore. They'll either go completely over to apostasy or they'll go completely to the cross for Jesus. 36. And the king hath done according to his will, and exalteth himself, and magnifieth himself against every god, and against the God of gods. He speaketh wonderful things, and hath prospered till the indignation hath been completed, for that which is determined hath been done. Antiochus Epiphanes said that he was the only god. He exalted himself above all of the false gods and the one true God. But the Antichrist is going to do the same thing. So this also, he will proclaim himself as the only God. 37. And unto the God of his fathers he doth not attend, nor to the desire of woman, yea, of any God he doth not attend, for against all he magnifieth himself. This seems to only be talking about the Antichrist because it doesn't really relate that well to Antiochus Epiphanes. I have a theory that the Antichrist will be Jewish, Muslim, and Catholic. Because in order to be Jewish and Muslim, it's a biological connection, and you could be Jewish and Muslim at the same time. You're Jewish if your father is Jewish, but your mother could be Muslim, and that would make you Muslim. So if the Antichrist has a Jewish father and a Muslim mother, then he's both. And if he has the Catholic religion, then he's also fully Catholic. So it is possible to be fully Jewish, fully Muslim, and fully Catholic at the same time. Where it says in this verse that he does not desire women, or he is not for the desire of women, it could mean multiple things. The Muslims treat women as property, so that's one way of interpreting it. The Catholics say that they believe in celibacy. For instance, the Pope claims that he's celibate and he does not have a wife. So that could also be not desiring women. That does kind of go along a little bit with my theory that the Antichrist will not have women in his life, or he will not treat them with any respect or love, one way or the other. But that's theory. You don't have to agree with me. Now, why would the Antichrist need to be Catholic, Jewish, and Muslim? It's because those are the three major religions of the world, and those three religions all claim some sort of ownership over Jerusalem. That's why the Antichrist would need to be all three. 38, and to the God of strongholds on his station he giveth honor, yea, to a God whom his fathers knew not he giveth honor, with gold and with silver and with precious stone and with desirable things. Allah is a God that the Muslims in antiquity did not know. He's a pretty new God. He doesn't go back very far in history. Allah is a God of war, which is strongholds. This kind of seems to be talking about the Antichrist being Muslim as well. But again, this is all theory. It's okay if you disagree. This verse also looks back to Antiochus, who made it a law to abolish his national religion and instead to honor the idols of the Greeks. And because people all over the world pay allegiance to the Pope also have some political influence in every land, and that's why all of the presidents and all of the kings visit the Pope, because the Pope does have power in their areas. 39, and he hath dealt in the fortresses of the strongholds with a strange God whom he hath acknowledged. He multiplieth honor and hath caused them to rule over many, and the ground he apportioneth at a price. This verse seems to go along with verse 38. 40, and at the time of the end, push himself forward with him doth a king of the south, and storm against him doth a king of the north, with chariots and with horsemen, and with many ships, and he hath come into the lands, and hath overflowed, and passed over. This could also be talking about the Antichrist, but I don't know how it would relate to the Antichrist. However, it does seem to be going back in time, talking about Antiochus Epiphanes again, because Egypt tried to defend itself against Antiochus, and Antiochus fought back with fury against Egypt, because Egypt did try one last stand against Antiochus, but they failed. 41, and hath come into the desirable land, and many do stumble, and these escape from his hand, Edom and Moab and the chief of the sons of Ammon. Antiochus kept fighting Egypt, and the pagan cousins to the Israelites sided with him and helped him for their own protection. And of course, that isn't the first time that Israel's cousins fought against them. This is a continuing theme all throughout history. 42, and he sendeth forth his hand upon the lands, and the land of Egypt is not for an escape. The Jews could not escape to Egypt because Antiochus was fighting Egypt as well as Israel. The Jews had nowhere to run. 43, and he hath ruled over treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the desirable things of Egypt, and Lubim and Cushim are at his steps. Antiochus spoiled wealth from the young king Philometor in Egypt. 44. And reports trouble him out of the east and out of the north, and he hath gone forth in great fury to destroy and to devote many to destruction. Antiochus is in a rage when he hears of the exploits of the Maccabees. 45. And he planteth the tents of his palace between the seas and the holy desirable mountain, and hath come unto his end, and there is no helper to him. All of these last few verses could have been talking about the Antichrist, but since the Antichrist isn't here yet, I don't really know how they relate to the Antichrist, because that's in the future. But they are definitely talking about Antiochus. He set up his royal pavilion at Emmaus near Jerusalem, and he died of a disease in 164 AD. This chapter ends in 164 AD. This is the beginning of when the Roman Empire was coming into power. By 31 BC, the Roman Empire was in full power. So this chapter is basically ending when Rome is rising. And Rome is the fourth empire that was mentioned in Daniel chapter 8. The final empire is the empire of the Antichrist, which Rome will play a part in, because remember, the legs were iron and those represented Rome on the statue that was seen in the vision. But the feet were made of iron and clay, so they had influence of Rome, but they also had clay, which showed those areas where Rome did not have influence. This is also one of the reasons why I believe that the Antichrist will be Catholic. The Lord has shown Daniel not any random piece of history, but specifically the history from Daniel's time until the fourth empire controls the world. And this empire will have partial control during the Antichrist's kingdom. Rome will be a function of the Antichrist. Chapter 12 will go straight into the tribulation and the end times with the Antichrist. And that concludes Daniel chapter 11.